Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture, to talk about his speaking trip to London and new ID developments in Britain. In addition, we'll talk about how well his book, Signature in the Cell, is holding up to the latest in scientific research. Dr. Meyer, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, it's great to be here, David.
You were in London. You were there to talk about your book, Signature in the Cell. Tell us about that.
Well, I gave a big talk in London. There's a new British group there called the Center for Intelligent Design, which represents a number of very well-established, prestigious scientists who approached us about 2 years ago when I was over speaking because of the Darwin Bicentennial celebration. And they, this group of scientists approached us and wanted to let us know that they were completely on side with intelligent design. And so it's been rather exciting to find that there is a network of scientific support for the theory of intelligent design in the UK with a lot of very prominent and well-established scientists who are doing some good work.
Let's review for listeners what your initial message, what your key message is from Signature in the Cell.
Yeah, you bet. The book Signature in the Cell is making an argument for intelligent design based upon the information-bearing properties of DNA and sister molecule RNA. The recognition since the late 1950s in molecular biology has been that information is running the show inside life, and that insight gave rise to what we call the molecular biological revolution, an incredibly successful flowering of scientific investigation. But that insight also caused an impasse in another related field, which is sometimes called origin of life studies, the attempt to explain the origin of the very first life. The more we learned about the inner workings of the cell, the more difficult it became to explain the origin of the cell by reference to purely undirected material processes. And the crucial feature that needed to be explained was the information that was directing the construction of proteins, which in turn perform all the important jobs in the cell. So if you want to explain life, you've got to explain information. It's a little bit like the modern software revolution. I used to ask my students, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they knew right away, code, information. And it's the same thing in life. If you want to build life from pre-existing non-living chemicals, you've got to arrange the chemicals in an informative way so that they can direct the construction of proteins. You have to get information in DNA to produce proteins.
I take the materialist view is that this information happens because of undirected chemical reactions, and then it just creates, basically by accident, an information code.
Yeah, you're very close to right on there. And that there was a theory of the origin of life that came about in the 1920s and 30s, and the idea was that life arose through a series of undirected chemical interactions. The problem came when we realized that life is based on the presence of information. You have to have this four-character digital code that's inscribed along the spine of the DNA molecule. The key insight was from Francis Crick, 1957. It was called the sequence hypothesis. It was a few years after he and Watson had elucidated the structure of DNA. And Crick proposed that these four chemicals, they're called bases. He said that these chemical bases function like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a machine code, which is to say it's not the chemical, it's not the shape or the chemical properties of these subunits of DNA that matter. It's the way they're arranged, just like, for example, Scrabble letters on a tabletop. If you arrange them properly, you can get the triple word score. If they're not arranged properly, they're just a pile of letters on the side of the board. And Crick realized that, like all informational systems, the arrangement of the bases in DNA was crucial to explain what the DNA does. They're actually, not metaphorically, but actually conveying instructions, they convey information. So when that realization came, then as people began to think about the origin of life, it reset the dial. It changed the parameters of debate because the central question then became, how do we explain information? Can we do it by chance? Can we do it by some kind of natural law? Is there some way to combine chance and natural law? And what I do in the book is I examine each of those different undirected naturalistic attempts to account for information and show that each are deeply problematic. And in fact, the problematic nature of those hypotheses is readily acknowledged in the technical literature. There is no accepted theory now of the origin of life by undirected chemical interactions, precisely because it has turned out to be so difficult to explain the origin of information.
Is there an analogy that you like to use to describe just how improbable it would be to get information out of non-information in terms of a code that might be able to create life?
One thing I've used in lectures to convey this is the idea of a bike lock. If you have one of those bike locks with four dials on it, and then you think, well, you're the bike thief out there in front of the building, and you go to try to unlock the combination by chance. Well, if you've got four dials and 10 settings at each, you've got 10,000 possible ways of arranging those numbers 1 through 10 on the four dials. If the thief has a long enough period of time, he can, by trial and error, search that space of possibilities and eventually get the right one. But now imagine that you've got a bike lock, not with four dials, but what if you got a bike lock with 150 dials or 300 dials? Now, the number of combinations doesn't increase additively. It increases exponentially. And this is what happens in biochemistry or molecular biology. Even a very short, modest protein is about 150 amino acids long. An average protein is about 300 amino acids long. But you've got 20 possible amino acids at each one of those dials, at each one of the connection points, the settings. And so there's such a vast number of possible combinations for a sequence of amino acids 150 long. You have one chance in 10 to the 195th power of getting a particular combination. And so these numbers, the size of these numbers just become exponentially so vast so quickly that the idea of searching those spaces by chance to find the few functional sequences among all the possible sequences, it's just not credible. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack the size of the Milky Way galaxy or something. There's not enough time since the beginning of the universe to search the space of possibilities to find the functional protein, to find the needle in the great big haystack.
Let's say you did find that needle in the haystack the size of the Milky Way galaxy. Wouldn't you then also have to find additional needles in the other haystacks the same size and bring them all together through happenstance so that they could get together to create life?
That's the correct way to apply the analogy, because one protein will not a cell make.
Right.
A minimally complex cell needs about 400 proteins, and you have to have so to get that going is a whole bunch of haystacks with tiny needles, and then you've got other cellular components too. So the chance hypothesis has been pretty much rejected. That's understating it. It's been entirely rejected by people who are specialists in this area of chemical evolutionary theory or origin of life studies, prebiotic chemistry. Relying on chance alone is not going to get the job done. Everyone accepts that. So people have moved on to other undirected naturalistic hypotheses, but those have also run into problems.
Since your book, Signature in the Cell, has come out, obviously science has very much been focused on DNA study and the study of information, as you put it. How has any of that new research affected your perspective since you've written that book?
Well, the book came out in 2009, and then the paperback was released in 2010. And one of the arguments I made near the end of the book was not just about the basics of molecular biology, the fact that you've got DNA with information-rich sequences that codes for the building of proteins, but also about new things we're learning about what computer scientists call the design patterns that are at work in the information processing system of the cell. We have one of the Microsoft Elite programmers who has worked with our lab. He was writing some software, 10,000 lines of code, to help simulate what's called the gene expression system, how the information in DNA directs the construction of proteins. And one day he walked into my office and he threw a book down on my table called Design Patterns. It's a standard design manual for computer software engineers. And he said, somewhat melodramatically, especially for a computer science guy, he says, I got an eerie feeling. He says that someone's figured this out before us. And I said, what do you mean? And he explains, well, I'm writing all this code to try to simulate not just the fact that DNA has information, which he says, I know is the bee in your bonnet, Steve, but it's not just the information. It's how the cell is processing the information. It's using all the same design patterns. And then he explained, that's a term of art, design strategies or a design logic. It's using all the same design strategies that we use in modern digital computing. There's a automated error correction in the cell. We have spell check. We have files within folders, folders within superfolders, superfolders within superduper folders, a hierarchical filing system on the desktop, but that's also what the cell uses to organize the information that it has on the chromosomes. And he explained how there's nested coding of information, messages encoded in other messages, an advanced technique used in cryptography. And he's finding all this sophisticated design logic in the way that the cell processes information. And so in the book, I actually describe this, but we've been learning more and more about this, even in very recent years. One thing that's come out is that the so-called junk DNA, the parts of the DNA that don't code for building proteins, is no longer thought to be junk at all. It's information, and it's performing a very sophisticated function. It is essentially functioning like an operating system that is timing the expression of the data files, the parts of the DNA that code for proteins. So the more we learn about the cell, the more we learn that it's a hierarchically arranged system of information that is mind-blowing in its complexity.
It's interesting you'd use that analogy of the operating system, because we've been hearing about the junk DNA, that this is proof that it's just chance, that we've got a bunch of junk there that nobody was using, which I think is a bit of a leap of logic myself, just with that argument alone. But once you discover that, hey, it does have a function, it is controlling the rest of these kinds of things, people can think of it as they do their computer. And the kinds of things that it doesn't appear to be doing anything on the surface, because it doesn't always have to be working, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have a function.
Well, in fact, it probably always is working now. And the year I was finishing the book, there were four or five books that had been published in just the previous year from a Darwinian point of view, saying, well, if the information, the genetic information in living systems is intelligently designed, why is so much of it junk? Why is so much of it useless, non-functional sequences? And the idea was that the Darwinists thought that this was actually what they expected, because mutation and natural selection is a kind of trial and error mechanism that would generate lots of meaningless sequences before a functional sequence was selected. And the ID people predicted the opposite. And what's interesting is that those predictions have come true, that since something called the ENCODE Project in 2007, there's been just a series of publications showing that the whole of the genome is transcribed. It performs multiple functions. And overall, again, it functions much like an operating system, directing the timing and regulating the expression of the information that does code for proteins. So it's fascinating. And it's actually, I think, a fairly decisive refutation of one of the key counterarguments to the case for intelligent design that we've made from the information-bearing properties of DNA.
Well, let me ask you this. With this new information coming forward, showing the complexity of the information involved, showing that the case for junk DNA gets diminished on a daily basis, has there been a softening among the larger scientific community toward your work?
Well, I think there has. Let me say two things about it. The first is that the discovery of these design patterns and the functional role of the non-coding, we shouldn't call it junk anymore, the non-coding regions of the genome, has reinforced the basic positive logic for intelligent design. A lot of people think that the case for intelligent design is just based on the critique of these failing naturalistic models. But there's a positive logic here that I think I should get on the table, and then we'll circle back to the other part of the question. And that is that whenever we find information and we trace it back to its source, we always come to a mind, whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription or a section of software code or a section of text on a headline in a newspaper or in a book, or information embedded in a radio signal. Whenever we find information and we bring it back to its ultimate source, we always come to an intelligence. So the discovery of information at the foundation of life in DNA and in RNA is a powerful indicator of prior intelligent activity. And in making that claim, I develop this as a positive argument. I'm actually using the method that Darwin himself pioneered in his book, The Origin of Species. I come to a non-Darwinian conclusion. I affirm that there's actual design, not just the illusion or appearance of design, which is the classic Darwinian view. But I use Darwin's own method of reasoning to get there, because what Darwin said was that if you compare competing hypotheses, and the best one is the one that's invoking a cause which is known to produce the effect in question, what he called the true cause, a cause which has the power to produce what you're trying to explain. When I realized that that was Darwin's method, I thought, this makes it possible to develop a positive scientific argument for intelligent design, because what we know from experience, from our uniform and repeated experience, which is the basis of all scientific reasoning, is that information always comes from an intelligent source. And therefore, the true cause of information, the cause we know about from our experience, is mind. It's not just an undirected process. So when we see that evidence of information in a living system, we're looking at positive evidence of a prior intelligent cause. And so these new developments that show that not only do we see information, but we see, in a sense, other fingerprints of intelligence, these design patterns that we know from only one realm of experience, which is the realm of computer software engineering, clearly the province of mind over matter, of intelligent design. We're seeing additional evidences for intelligent design that strengthen the core case that I make in Signature in the Cell.
So has the reaction, I mean, I agree with you on all that, has the reaction of the scientific community been softening or hardening because of this challenge to their orthodox view?
When the book was first published, there was a series of book reviews at a website called BioLogos, which was started by Francis Collins, who is a critic of intelligent design, even though he believes that God and science go together. But at the website, there was a book review by a man named Francisco Ayala, leading evolutionary biologist. And he raised the junk DNA question in the review and said that junk DNA disproves the argument for intelligent design. And he had a particular kind of junk sequence he cited. I responded to that, and our listeners can find that on my website where I've cataloged all the responses, showing that actually, even though Francisco Ayala is a very prominent biologist, he was about 15 years out of date on the whole question of junk DNA. And at first, the BioLogos website wasn't going to publish the response, and they finally agreed. And then we published a series of technical responses about all the different functions that junk DNA performs and all the different parts of the genome that perform those different functions. And this was written primarily by Richard Sternberg, who was at the Smithsonian and at Gene Bank, the National Institute of Health. He's an expert on this whole question of the non-coding regions of the genome. And I think the interaction between ourselves and some of the scientists at BioLogos really moved the ball forward on this. Recently, Francis Collins himself has acknowledged that junk DNA is an inapt term to describe the DNA. And one of the guys who was directing the BioLogos site, Daryl Falk, actually at a certain point took the discussion offline. He said, it's clear these people at Discovery are real scientists. They're on top of this literature. And he invited his audience. He said, you know, if you think I've underestimated the functional role that the non-coding regions of DNA are playing, and you're a molecular biologist, talk to me offline. So I think there were a lot of people watching that exchange. And I think a lot of people have realized that's not a good argument now to make against intelligent design.
It'll be a slow change. I've seen, it surprised me how virulent the attacks on the Discovery Institute and the evidence of intelligent design is for challenging the materialist worldview, I think, above all else.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you have any second thoughts about doing these interviews with us.
I actually had a friend say, you don't want to do that.
You don't want to get involved with these people.
You don't want to get involved in that. Yeah. I'm not going to shrink from that. What about, as we alluded to earlier, you visited the new Center on Intelligent Design in England. What kind of challenges are they facing? What kind of response are they facing? And what was your overall impression?
Well, it's really interesting because you talk about the intensity of the reaction to intelligent design. I started my talk in London by the way, not all the people there were advocates of intelligent design. They had invited a very distinguished audience. There were members of the House of Lords, vice chancellors of universities, a lot of academic biologists and philosophers of various persuasions on this. But I started my talk by saying what a pleasure it was to actually get to explain the basic idea and case for intelligent design to a British audience. I studied over there, so I kind of know the scene. But the main reason that I found it a pleasure was that they never had a Scopes trial. And in the United States, if you begin to talk about this, people are absolutely sure before you say anything that they know what you're saying, that you're talking about a form of young earth creationism that is biblically based. It's a literalistic interpretation of the passages of Genesis. And while a lot of the British people have heard that because of the American media, they're not quite so paranoid about it. And it's kind of nice to be able to start fresh with an audience that doesn't think they already know what you're saying before you say anything.
Yeah, I had that conversation today when I told someone I was going to be interviewing you about this. That was their first reaction. I said, you're totally misinformed. So what are your hopes for the new institute in Britain?
Well, it's really not our institute. It's the indigenous British group. But I think it's just terrific to see the way the...
That's even better, isn't it?
Well, of course it's better. Yeah. And what we have is a... In the last couple of years, I would say that the ID, the intelligent design research community, has gone international. The British group is one of those groups that shows that internationalization. We also have a new journal called Biocomplexity that has a very prestigious editorial board with scientists from all around the world, members of national academies from different countries. And so I think it's really an exciting thing to have the network of ID-friendly scientists grow around the world, because it's very helpful to have it break out of a strictly American context.
Dr. Meyer, thanks so much for the update on Signature in the Cell.
Thank you for having me on.
Hi, this is Casey Luskin with ID the Future. As the year of 2011 comes to an end, I want to thank you for listening to Discovery Institute's ID the Future podcast. It's been gratifying this past year to hear comments from students who tell us that ID the Future helps them get through their pro-Darwin biased courses and keeps them informed of the ID world. I hope that ID the Future has benefited you this past year as well. It takes money to create ID the Future, as well as all of the other work we do here at Discovery Institute. For example, much of the work that I do defending academic freedom for pro-ID scientists doesn't happen in a vacuum. We need the support of ID the Future listeners to keep these important projects going. If you'd like to make a contribution, go to www.idthefuture.com and click the donate button. Just go to idthefuture.com and click the orange donate button on the left-hand side. Thanks again for listening and for supporting us this past year.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Copyright 2011, The Discovery Institute, all rights reserved. For more information, please visit discovery.org/CSC.